All right, do it to it.
The Linux Link Tech Show. The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to the latest in GNU Linux and technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up. Link it up. And take it away. Take it away.
Yeah, baby. 2 hours.
2 hours.
All right. For all you losers who missed this last week because, well, let me check. The Audacity crashed and our hard drive filled up. Some special news from Erin. She's got some additions since last week. She can talk about her new toy, but
the new additions.
Tell her, yeah,
she's going to sing it for us.
Yeah, tell her what you did the other week.
So this is what you tech geek folks call a do-over, right?
A do-over.
what am I supposed to talk about? Oh, again.
Since we missed it the first time.
All right. Do-over.
It's called a do-over. My friend Nydia from my work. No, that's a whole different thing. My friend Nydia at work, her husband bought her a computer for Valentine's Day. And
how romantic.
It is, actually. It could have been.
I'm trying to get my wife to buy me a computer for Valentine's Day.
Oh, yeah. But
I don't want to tap that ass, right?
Stop.
You got Link all flustered.
Tech Show Mountain.
I'm just going to give him such a slap. She's speechless now.
I'm completely speechless. I am. I need another beer. My friend Nydia got a computer for Mother's Day, and it's really old. He was trying to do a real nice thing, but it's a very old computer. They don't have any money. And she was grousing about, you know, how old it was and how they can't put anything on it, and they can't afford Windows, and it won't fit on there anyway. And I said, well, you know, my husband could put Linux on there so you could surf the web, which is all she really wants to do. You'd be able to do that, and it would probably fit on there. It would work a lot better, and it wouldn't cost you anything. And she was all for it, so I brought it home, and Danny said, well, this is going to be a real challenge. Like, I guess it is really, really old. But he put Damn Small Linux on it. Is that what you put on it? And
is that what's up there right now?
Really old, as in, like, the power supply consists of two sticks and a rock.
The modem is two tin cans and a string.
Is
yes.
Is that it up there, Dan?
It's right there. Is that up
that's
there?
It, right
that's
there.
Oh, is it?
That looks great, man.
That's it. Yeah, it looks awesome, yeah.
That
started
looks
right
fair.
Up, too. I watched him start it up.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. I'll probably take it in.
Getting the web browser going, that's a whole different thing.
What?
Still stuck.
Oh. Okay. Well, anyway, I pimped out my husband. I pimped out Linux. The thing that I thought was kind of neat is that my friend Nydia and her husband, they live in downtown Allentown. They've got no money whatsoever.
That's neat.
Yeah. And they were really into it. Before I said that, I don't think they even really knew about Linux. I think when I talk about it, they kind of just, you know, stop listening. But there's no way they could have afforded Windows, was it XP Home Edition or whatever the heck it is. And it wouldn't have fit on that computer anyway. So now they have a computer that works for free, and that's a good thing.
Yay!
All right.
Yay!
You know, talking into the microphone holder isn't going to do anything.
I know.
But you keep talking into it.
I'm trying to echo over
that. That's
what it is. Oh, okay. Should I repeat it's my shout out to man. your friend?
Yeah, go ahead. Is he listening this week? Go ahead.
Okay.
He's always listening.
We were driving to Hershey a couple weeks ago. This all happened so long ago now since we lost last week. And Danny was telling...
She's bringing that up, you know. That's like a painful memory already.
I'm sorry. Does it
twist
hurt?
The knife.
Does it hurt? Oh.
Twist.
Have you not met me before, Link? And he said that y'all have a listener who is a long-distance truck driver who pulls over every Wednesday night to make sure to catch the show live. What was his name?
Tech Wizard.
And I just thought that was the coolest thing I ever heard. And Tech Wizard, you are awesome. I'm very impressed. That's just the coolest thing ever in my book. Oh, and I bought an MP3 player. Is that the other thing I was supposed to
what
talk
you
about?
Got? Mm.
Oh, yeah. I went to Radio Shack. Oh. A
lot of bright ones over there.
What?
A lot of bright ones over there.
Well, yeah. You
transistor?
Know,
what's the transistor?
The sales guys are a little maladjusted.
Jimmy, do we have any transistors?
They don't even do that anymore, no. A lot of them.
But
no,
I,
they don't.
I got a SanDisk. It was cheap. It was really cheap. It was $70. SanDisk something or other, 512 megabytes. But pop it into the back of my laptop, and the device comes right up, and I couldn't be happier.
Cool.
What else am I supposed to talk about?
USB mass storage?
Yeah.
Yeah, it just pops up.
That's how it sees it. Yeah, it looks at it like a mass storage device, like a flash, like a stick memory.
Well, you know, Radio Shack saved millions of dollars by switching from Linux to Windows. You ever seen those ads on like Linux Today?
No.
They have this flash ad going, you know, get the facts out. Radio Shack saves millions of dollars switching from Linux to Windows.
Yeah, it's because Windows paid them to do it. Yeah.
Really? Well, now I feel like I should take it back just on principle. I didn't know that. But anyway, from a non-tech perspective.
Take it back, tell them they suck, and ask them for a thermistor.
You know who does run Linux? Burlington Coat Shop.
Yes.
They do.
Yes,
yeah.
They do.
Red Hat.
Yes, they do.
Actually, my work is putting in Linux-based database to replace their very old proprietary database. It runs in an Apache server. The old one was on SCO.
Do you know what kind of database it is? Is it MySQL, Oracle, Postgres?
No flipping idea.
I don't know.
It's a thing that runs on the thing.
It goes in the closet and it hums. Honestly, I think it's MySQL, but I don't know why I think that.
Because MySQL is good.
Homework says Home Depot and Lowe's also runs Linux.
Yes, it does.
Who does?
Lowe's.
Home Depot and Lowe's.
Mm-hmm.
Lowe's, like the hardware?
Lowe's, yeah, the hardware store.
There's a Lowe's going in right down the street from us, and I can't freaking wait because I hate Home Depot.
You'll never see it.
I'll never see it. What does that mean?
Because it's for home improvement, and Dan put the kibosh on that. He said, nope.
No more improvement.
Not until I get a new laptop.
When's it supposed to be
finished? I don't know. I think next 6 or 8 weeks, so maybe I won't see it. Should I tell the tell the big news?
I didn't want to jinx it.
Where I'm working right now, I'm a contractor for a different company, and the company that actually pays my paychecks is flying me down to another one of their facilities right outside of Virginia Beach for a job interview. It's on the shore, so if it goes well, we might think about making the move. So,
ooh.
And I said I wasn't going to say anything. I wasn't going to jinx it, and I just did. So, I have no self-control whatsoever.
You jinxed. That's
I'm
it.
Jinxed.
You're done. Hang it up now.
Yeah,
it's all over.
I have a phone interview tomorrow, so you know, wish me luck or not. If you want Danny to stick around forever and ever and ever until he dies in the Lehigh Valley.
I don't care if he goes to Virginia Beach, as long as he's back here every Wednesday.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case. There you go. Well, if he stays, y'all get custody of him. So,
I can handle it.
Yeah, you got to feed him and clothe him and.
Nah, you just cut a slot and roll a beer under the door every now and then.
All right. Well, that's it for me. And I hope this one records, but I don't want to twist the knife any further than I already have. I've made Link cry. It's not pretty.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
We'll find a mystery. Go find a mystery for the BBC.
Oh.
They're too quiet. You both are in here. That means something is wrong.
Yeah. They're not in the bathtub. Hell must have froze over. All right. Let's talk some damn small Linux here.
Talking.
Did you guys listen to the damn small Linux Red interview on DistroWatch?
Yes.
And it's, you know.
Nope.
The two guys that put this thing together, the primarily two guys, I don't think either one of them are programmers. Was that it? Do you remember, Pat?
I don't think so. I don't think they're programmers. They know scripting and packaging.
Yes, and the idea for damn small Linux is to be a really lightweight distribution that will run on really older hardware.
Uh-huh.
And comes on a live CD. And what my wife gave me to install Linux on is is a real challenge. This is almost, you know, back to when we were doing the CFK stuff.
Oh yeah.
And what we have is a Pentium 200 with originally 24 megs of RAM and a 1.6 gig hard drive. And I went over to Mark's on Friday, and we were scavenging some stuff together. What we managed to throw in there was 32 megs of RAM,
mm-hmm.
Total now, and everything else.
Total of 32 megs.
Yeah, everything else remains the same. So I had downloaded Damn Small Linux at home, and I took it over there, and we popped it in, and it would not boot. This system, it turns out, will not boot using the ISO Linux boot. The ISO Linux boot format.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to use the SysLinux boot format.
Oh man!
So we had
a crusty machine, man.
It is. So we had to download another copy of Damn Small Linux with the SysLinux boot capability, and he's got DSL over there, but it's like really slow for downloading. It is horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's better than nothing anyway. After we got that thing down and burned, we booted right up into Damn Small Linux and did a hard drive install using their script, and that's the fastest Linux installation I've ever done.
How big of a hard drive is it?
It's 1.6 gig.
1.6.
So all we had to do was format the partition and then partition the hard drive, and then it went through the whole process of formatting it and then dropping down Damn Small Linux.
Did you add a swap partition?
Yes. Yes, we did. We have a 128 meg swap partition, and then the rest is used for the rest of the Linux, the root partition.
Mm-hmm.
And it took about, I was surprised, it took under 10 minutes for this thing to install itself onto the hard drive, the whole thing.
Whee.
And we've rebooted, and of course, it boots a hell of a lot faster when you boot it from the hard drive instead of the CD.
Mm-hmm.
And we set it for multiple user instead of just one regular user, and figured that I would create more accounts on there. As we started playing around with it, it was pretty responsive. We initially started with the 24 megs of RAM, and noticed that it kept locking up for some reason, and we suspected that the RAM was bad. And when we replaced the RAM, the lockups on it subsided pretty much, and it only has locked up maybe once or twice since then.
That's pretty good.
And it's really fast, really snappy. Dillo, Pathetic Writer, is that what's on there?
Mm-hmm.
I think this is it. You pull this thing up, and oh no, that's the wrong thing. But I can't even see that, it's so far away. You get like a couple of different editors, and the programs on here, while they're very nice, they are very different than maybe what somebody who's used to Office might or Windows might be accustomed to. Like, you can create a new document. I'm kind of concerned that this might not import Word documents. I don't know. So,
It might not, but like,
they could do text.
Under 32 megs of RAM, I don't think you could get a Word document on there anyway.
It has a Word converter, document converter, spreadsheet and stuff like that. And we were looking at, I heard that there was a repository out there for Damn Small Linux, and we decided to check that out. So we started pulling applications down off the repository, like Abbey Word and other things. And Abbey Word comes up, not as fast as the other one. It's a little pokey, but nowhere near as slow as the Pig Firefox is. That thing, it comes with two browsers, Dillo and Firefox. And Dillo is, like, really fast and snappy. The only problem with Dillo is it's really trips over a lot of pages.
It's quite limited. Yeah,
yeah, it's got some serious limitations to it. But Firefox is in there. Unfortunately, it's pretty pokey on this machine.
Well,
so
you got to stop and think that what you have on there is absolute current and modern software running on a computer that is 10 years old.
Oh, no. I agree with you.
On, you know, a tenth of less than a tenth of the RAM that people really want you to have. So
we went out, and I pulled down some software, a couple of things. Abbey Word was one of them, and a few others. And it has its own little package management system called MyDSL.
Mm-hmm.
And what irked me about it to begin with was you had to be logged in as the DSL account to install packages.
Mm-hmm.
You do it as root. You couldn't do it as any other account but the MyDSL, which was, I thought, kind of odd. But anyway, as we're trying to figure out how to install packages on here and do different things, after doing it manually, we suddenly came upon this right here on the desktop, which says My DSL.
Right.
And are you familiar with this?
Yeah.
And I was, did I click on it?
There you go.
I was pleasantly surprised that this distribution put together by, you know, these two guys, and I wish we'd have the name of these two guys instead of me just keep saying these two guys. Somebody look it up.
I tried getting a hold of them, and they never responded to me. I'd like to talk to them.
They got this package management system here where you just click on a category of packages, like for games, for instance, and it brings up this list right here. And you can go in and just click on one of these, and it'll bring up an info page and tell you what the game is, if it has any kind of requirements or any application, you know, requirements. You click the download, downloads and installs it for you.
Yep.
Now, these two guys.
Damn nifty, ain't it?
You're darn right. I got to say, these two guys come up with a Spartan package management system that works.
Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the time.
It's graphical. Yep. It's graphical. It's informative. It's really easy to use. It's probably the easiest package management system front end I've ever seen. And it does a fantastic job. These two guys have put together a package management system interface no other distribution has put together. I mean, like this. Compared to SUSE, SUSE's Yast, which is a dog slow of it. I found this like, wow, I was really impressed. I mean, it does have its limitations. All right, okay, it's a very small repository because it's designed for small systems.
Yes.
But it's very, very functional. Mm-hmm. Works pretty well. Just about every package I've installed in here has worked fine, mm-hmm. except for two of them. Tux Paint and Tux Typing didn't work properly. I had to make some augmentations to it for some reason for it to actually work. But if we go over here to the games, and what is that? Are those L games?
Yes.
L Breakout. Remember this game?
Mm-hmm.
We had on there. I am surprised for a Pentium 200 system with only 32 megs of RAM.
It's working.
How well this thing works.
Yeah.
Look at that. That's there's no blips there. There's no hiccups. It's just
nice and smooth.
It's working just fine.
It's like butter.
It is working just fine, and that amazes me. So I'm looking at the different packages on here, and I'm saying to myself, you know, at least now we have something that their kid's probably going to enjoy.
Get Excalibur on there, too.
That's I have Excalibur on here.
That's a good game.
I got the... which one of these is Circus Linux?
That would be under C there.
That one?
A couple up.
There?
Right there. There you go.
Circus Linux actually works pretty well. Remember, did we put that on the CFK distribution?
I believe we did, yes.
And good stuff. Good stuff. There's a little pokiness, but it works.
I think it's pretty cool. I've always liked damn small Linux.
And this just requires the mouse right here.
What game is that? K-Circus?
This is Circus Linux.
Circus Linux.
That's cool.
So if you're familiar at all with Circus Atari, and no hiccups there. Smooth gameplay. So at least they'll be able to play some games on here, maybe not surf the web with full flash brilliance and visit YouTube. But there we go. Damn small Linux.
Yeah, but they couldn't. There's nothing they could do under such a meagerly equipped machine.
Oh, yeah.
To surf the web.
And, you know, I'm not,
you know,
yeah, I'm not here
blown anyway, so.
Trying to say, you know, this is the fault of Damn Small Linux, because it's absolutely not. I mean, they've done a phenomenal job to actually resurrect the Pentium 200 system with modern software.
And make
it
usable.
A really difficult
yeah.
task. And, see, there's Abbey Word. Mm-hmm. Abbey Word comes up. It's not, you know, not that bad of a, not that slow, but.
It's slow, but it's usable.
Yeah, it's very usable once it comes up. And I'm thinking that might be able to pull in some of their Word documents.
Sure.
With some ease. So,
now, there's two versions of Damn Small. There's the original Damn Small, and then there's the bigger version that they're working on. Do you know about
that? Damn Small NG?
Yeah, it's got a little more, you know, the limitation was, what, 60 meg? 50 meg?
Right.
They've upped it to, like, 200 meg, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is a good idea. I mean, you know, if you're running modern hardware, there's nothing wrong with going a little higher.
No. But we also tried a few other distributions, Feather Linux and...
Puppy. What do you think of Puppy?
No,
Linux?
Peanut. I didn't try Puppy. That's right.
Well, Peanut Linux isn't really around that much now. It's what, A Linux or something like that. Or?
I forget what it is now. But neither one of those. You know, they wanted to do the ISO Linux as opposed to the Sys Linux boot, and it was just getting to be a pain in the ass trying to get those on here. Maybe I'll try booting Nopix off of here.
Oh, man.
Full KDE desktop.
In just under 15 hours. Boot time.
You know what? You got to try Carrara with the XGL.
Oh, yeah. And a lawsuit, right?
I don't know, man. I haven't heard anything about it. They stopped development on that version of it. Because Carrara was basically a quick and easy way to install Gentoo without all the freaking compiling.
Right.
But if it doesn't have the compiling, is it really Gentoo?
No.
Well, you got everything on there, and going forward, it is Gentoo.
But it's not tuned.
But
you're
losing the whole mystique of Gentoo.
You haven't gone through the masochistic four-day install.
That's right.
I've done that twice.
Crazy talk.
Twice too many times.
Crazy talk.
We're going to have those guys on next month, by the way. Gentoo. And Fedora Quarto.
Shoot, I know what I wanted to do today.
What did you
What I've been meaning
to do
for the past 3 days.
Watch Shower?
Elephant Dreams.
Oh, you haven't watched it?
I have not watched
it
yet.
It was really good.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It was odd, but it was good.
Yeah, and then the audio is a little off. You notice that?
It depends on the machine. Depends on the machine.
I don't know if that's the way they did it.
Well, at work, I thought it was a little off, and at home, it looked pretty much right on to me. So, I think it depends on the machine.
Because most of the guys who do that are Dutch.
Yeah, well, you know.
Well, we'll talk to the main dude.
Maybe they didn't notice. You don't know.
Next week, we have Mark Shuttleworth on there.
Yes, we're talking. That's actually going to be pre-recorded. We're talking to him on Monday.
That puts a cramp in like the holiday a day, doesn't it? 3 o'clock on Monday.
No, it's 11
o'clock.
Man.
3 o'clock their time.
Oh, 3 o'clock their time. Oh, it's 11. Oh, that's better.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
It's right when I would be putting the virgin. The hot dogs on
now,
the grill.
Who's he? How are we doing?
Get in my
he's
belly.
Calling us.
He's calling us through the asterisk here?
Yes.
Okay, because I definitely want to be in on that. And,
absolutely.
And we're all going to get on the asterisk and talk to him?
Me too.
I'll come over if you'd like. I'll bring some beers over.
That's up to you, man.
You got a barbecue, man? I'll throw some hot dogs on.
We'll find that out tomorrow, whether we have a barbecue or Friday, if we go out and buy one.
I guess that's a no.
You know, we want to get a new grill, but it's either that or get a propane tank for the old one.
Decisions.
Propane works pretty well.
Yeah, but I'm sick of propane. I want charcoal. I want.
Got to get those carcinogens into your system faster.
That's right.
That's it. Makes it good, man.
I want flavor.
Yes.
It's going to kill me.
Get the cancer from the barbecue.
Oh, you don't think you get the carcinogens from the gas just burning
it's a little cleaner.
The hell out of your meat, right?
Well, you get the carcinogens from the rust from, like, the grill.
It's just good old dirt. There's nothing bad about that at all.
Yeah, but the thing is, people been eating off of the charcoal grills for how long now?
That's right.
And how many of them got cancer from it?
None of them, but then again, they only lived till they were 30 years old.
Goddamn sandwich tigers freaking biting their asses off.
Yeah.
That's what you get back in the days of freaking Tyrannosaurus Rex. You know, you build that fire to cook your... build that fire to cook your little weevil or whatever, and big sumbitchin' dinosaur comes and eats your ass.
Oh, shit.
You don't even realize that you've been inundated with
carcinogens. So where's Alan, man? Did he get the HIV?
So, I think
he's helping
like
his mother-in-law move. Was that today?
Or no, I thought he's getting ready for that or something like that.
Good evening. How are you doing today?
Hello. Good.
Hey, Bassam, how are you? This is Pat.
Good.
Can you hear us okay?
Yep. Pretty much.
Excellent.
All right. Well, let me introduce our guest. We've got Bassam Kardali, who is the director of Elephant Stream, the world's first open source movie. Bassam, welcome to the show.
Bassam, could you understand the thing Pat said?
Excuse me, I didn't hear that.
Did you understand? Did you hear what Pat said?
I I'm not sure, actually. Could you repeat it?
Did you hear what Pat just said? He introduced you. Did you hear that clearly?
I did hear that. I just didn't hear you asking.
Okay.
Well, today your microphone's not working.
Yeah, because usually people can't hear Pat, and I just wanted to make sure you could hear him.
Thank you.
All right. Well, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
And you are the responsible for Elephant Dreams.
Elephant Dream, yeah.
Elephant's Dream. And the first, the winner of the open source Blender or Blender open source movie contest, yes?
That's true. It's the first, well, I mean, it's the first that I know of open source animated movie to be made and released in this way. I'm the director, but it's also a very democratic project, like many open source projects are. So, I probably share the blame pretty equally with the other team members as to how the movie ended up looking in the end.
Now, the movie's released on the Creative Commons, correct? The movie's released on the Creative Commons.
It is released on the Creative Commons, but I believe it's the Creative Commons attribution license, which I think it's pretty liberal. I think you can do pretty much anything you want with the file, so long as you follow the kind of attribution restrictions that are there, which means I think you have to keep the credits on the movie or mention the original makers of it. But other than that, people are free to do whatever they want with it, including make their own versions or use it for commercial projects or just for learning or whatever they want.
How long did it take you to make this movie?
It took us 7 months total. Our initial timeline was for 6 months. We had a brief meeting in July for about a week where we discussed things and planned things out. Then we met again in September and worked through till the seven-month period was over. We did have to extend for 1 month during that time because we were getting pretty crunched time-wise at the end there. But we were fairly on time.
Now, does that 7 months, is that just you guys working in Blender, or does that include, you know, writing the script and drawing up the storyboards and everything?
Yeah, that's actually pretty interesting. When we first planned the project out and we met in July, we kind of hammered out the initial concept, and you know, we had planned to have a script at the beginning of that, you know, 7 month period. But what happened was the person who was supposed to write the script, who was hired for the task, kind of quit between July and September, and we didn't really find out until fairly late in the game that we really didn't have a script. And so when we met in September, we had to find a new scriptwriter, and we had to then work with that person. That was Kapan Wannenberg, and then we had to work with him to develop the script. And so we thought we'd be getting into design and production fairly quickly, but we ended up working a lot on story development. The first 3 months were just work on story development, I think, and we only really got into the thick of production halfway through. Yeah.
Now, are you part of the Blender developmental team or testing team or anything, or are you just a Blender user?
No. In fact, only one, actually, no, two of the team members are Blender developers. Tony, the technical director, is an obvious one candidate to be a Blender developer, and he's mostly interested in the Python scripting side of the program. And Matt, who's a graphic designer, also is interested in, he works in Blender development mainly in the UI design side of things. And so we had two Blender devs in the, you know, in the artist team, and also Tan Rosendahl, the producer, is the main core developer of Blender. So we had him pretty much full-time working on programming for the project. The rest of us were just using Blender. We had one guy, Lee, who was mostly just animating with a little bit of modeling. And then we had a generalist artist like Matt and Basse and myself a little bit. And with me concentrating more on the animation side. And then we had Andy, who was the art director, and he was mostly, while he did a little bit of animation, he was also responsible for the look of the movie. And so all the praises that I've heard and how great the movie looks are really due to his and Matt's efforts that it looks so nice in the end.
Well, let me ask you, what was your main goal for producing this short film? Was it as a demo of what Blender can do?
I think it differs depending on which team member you talk to. For the core team who was working on the movie, I think our interest is always predominantly in making animated movies. And for us, that was our primary goal. We wanted to make this movie. From Tom's perspective, it was definitely that side of things that he wanted to reintroduce the link between the programmer and the user had experience before Blender went open source, and it used to be an in-house production with artists, developers happening on the field. So I guess it does differ in that way. But Tan's primary motivation was to test the software out and to both see that it could do a modern production and at the same time fix and improve all the places it needed to be improved.
So there were coding changes based upon what you're saying then as you went along. There were improvements made to Blender as you went along?
Excuse me, you got cut off a little bit again there.
So were they coding changes made to Blender as the project progressed?
One more time, please.
Were there coding changes made to Blender as the project progressed based upon your feedback?
Oh yes, quite a lot. Quite a lot. We had a list of things that we presented to Tan at the beginning of the project, and that list got constantly modified as we were working on it. The animation system in Blender actually went through a rewrite in the summer preceding the project. The animation system that the previous 2.37 version of Blender had would not have been enough to make the movie. If for no other reason than it was way, way too slow in responsiveness. Anton actually rewrote the animation core of the program and introduced some more modern concepts into it. A little bit technical, but for instance, the kind of old way the system used to work, you would get an animation in a scene is, you get a bunch of things depending on each other in a rather complicated network, especially for a character. And to get everything to get updated per frame as it should be, Blender used to go through the entire scene twice to evaluate all the different dependencies. And this is extremely slow. So the new system uses what's called a dependency graph, which has a stored network of which object depends on which other object, and when it's doing the animation, it just traverses that graph and updates only the things that need to be made, and it only does it once. And so you get a much, much faster system, and things that don't move or don't change just don't get evaluated per frame, and that really lets an animator work in an almost real-time fashion and get the right feedback to patients. But also a lot more improvements were put into the program for the animation side to make a collaborative project possible to move linking files. And even for rendering and editing, the sequence editor in Blender got a big overhaul into another developer's work, David Clayley, and that also sped it up considerably. And so we were able to use Blender as editing program for the project. And Tan, for the post-processing features, added in a node compositor in Blender. And I'm pretty confident that Blender right now is the best open source compositing application that exists. There are some other projects in development, like JChemistry, but Blender was usable. And that system did not exist in Blender before. It happened in the last 2 months of the project, so there was considerable development during these 6 month period.
So all of these changes that you did to Blender then made it back into the Blender project itself and are available
right.
for the rest of the community to use?
Right. I think all the features that made it in from the project are in mainline CVS right now.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been one or two quick hacks that we did to get things working quickly that subsequently got replaced by more correct code. But yeah, I mean, you can get you can test out the current CVS of Blender or when the release 2.42 release comes out, and just be capable of dealing with all the files that we have for the project.
Now, what was your ultimate goal for this project? What is it that you really wanted to see happen out of it? Is it that you just wanted to? Is it like a proof of concept thing? Like, yes, I can make a good looking animated movie through Linux, or is it you wanted to go through and make the correct changes to Blender so that Blender was capable of doing this kind of stuff? Did you want to win a contest? What was your real motivation behind it?
Well, I mean, I think we wanted to make a good movie. I think that was a very powerful driving goal for all of us, including Don. And we wanted to get the exposure out there that you could make such a movie in Blender. So we did have some software marketing, if you want to put it that way, driver behind it. So for instance, I think the movie was more, I mean, we used a more complex kind of 3D looking rendering style that is not too much on the side of stylization and the cartoony look. We didn't consider too much because we wanted something that showed off some of the technical capabilities of the program. At the same time, we did want to avoid making something that was too close to sort of a real human beings interacting. We wanted to make them stylized at the same time, like that now. But we do want the project to be in various festivals, distribution outside of the internet, for which we are submitting it to festivals right now. But I don't think it's a good goal to have in your mind when you're making a movie or something like this, that I'm doing it to win a contest of some sort. I think it's better to have. I think it. At least for me personally, it works better if you have a real desire to make movies, and that is the goal in and of itself. And winning things is nice, I think, but the best part of that makes it.
The more noble goal, then.
And, well, I mean, perhaps. I wouldn't quite put it that way. I think, in a sense, it's a very egoistic goal to create something and then have people, you know, watch it. There's some kind of, I don't know, a bragging element to, I think, it. But I think that's okay. I mean, I think most artists like to show off, you know, a bit. So that's fine.
So why Linux then? Why Linux? Why Blender? I mean, obviously,
well,
you guys have a lot of talent between you all. Why did you settle upon that to, you know, that combination in particular to use your expressiveness, your talent?
Well, actually, from the wide blender aspect of it, that's a pretty easy one to answer. Tom Rosendahl's blender developer is the guy who started the project, and he started it to do an animation project in Blender and not in software. And he contacted us to do that project. So while we are all Blender users, I don't think he had these. I mean, he wouldn't have been allowed to use another software project. But besides that, all of us are Blender artists and not 3ds Max users or Maya users. And, I don't think from a practical perspective we could have chosen another software package either, because our proficiency remained like in that school. And Blender is actually an incredibly capable package. It's not just because it's open source, but it's actually a very good used piece of software. Despite comments often made on how steep the learning curve on the interface is, once you learn that interface, it's extremely fast to work with. To the extent that you sometimes feel hampered when you're using other software. And why Linux is an interesting question. It wasn't exactly Linux that we were trying to test. I think everyone is pretty confident that you can make movies using Linux workstations and systems. Many of the big studios are Linux-based, either in part or in full. But we did want to test the creative applications in open-source software. So we wanted to try using the GIMP and not Photoshop, and we wanted to try using various smaller applications to manage the project and to do the various tasks that were involved. We did in fact use Linux on most of our workstations, but there were actually I think two Mac OS X machines in the studio, and the render farm that we used, that was actually, it was a Bowie State University donation that they allowed us to use their rendering, their cluster system to render the movie, is running on Mac OS X and not Linux. But other than that, all the visual aspects of the movie are created with open source software.
Now, how long have you yourself been using Blender?
Let's see. That's a difficult question. I can't actually remember. I think I started using it from around the 2.2 version. Most Blender users remember the version they started with better than they remember when it was. I want to say that's about 4 or 5 years, maybe less, but it's harder for me to remember the exact date. So maybe since 2002 or so, I would guess was the date that version came out. I think I started to use Blender shortly before it became open source, actually.
Okay.
And continued to use it through that period.
Now, prior to using Blender, did you use other 3D
yes.
modeling tools?
Yes, I used Studio Max for a period, and I used Animation Master for another period of time. And before that, I think I took a class using Infinity or something like that. That I haven't used since then. I don't know if it still exists anymore, actually. So Animation Master and 3D Studio Max were my main programs before I started using Blender, actually.
Now,
and those are both closed.
Did you go to school to learn how to use these applications, the ones prior to Blender?
No, I didn't. I was actually an electrical engineering major in college, and I did take a 3D animation class in my senior year while I was there under the computer science department. So I have a total of one semester's worth of formal training in computer graphics, and I think I learned about I just learned the very basic beginnings that from that class back then. That was when I used Infinity. At the time my home computer was a 386, and I couldn't really do that much at home, I sort of slowly started doing it more and more as my hardware became more and more capable. And I got really serious about it in the past 5 or 6 years, I think.
The reason why I ask is because I have on occasion, and this is probably going back a good 3 or 4 years now, every so often, I come back to Blender and just, you know, take a look at it, and I have found it pretty difficult to work with. And, you know, I got to preface that with the fact that I've never worked with a 3D modeling application before in my life. So, you know, this is me pulling up the application and going to some of the online documentation and tutorials, and I found it, you know, really challenging to learn this.
It is, but I don't know actually that Blender alone is the reason for it being so challenging. It is definitely a lot harder to, a 3D graphic suite is not a lot like, let's say, a word processor or an editor or an email program or even a 2D graphics program. Which you can sort of pick up and start to work intuitively more and more. Sometimes you can. I mean, some people and some applications will click together and you'll find that they do things. They start to work in a more gradual way. But especially for a program like Blender, it is hard because the degree of complexity that it has, which has a lot to do with the scope. It's a very broad scoped application. It's a full 3D animation suite. You can do everything in the application, from modeling, rendering, animation. You can make games, and you can do things with a very high degree of power and control. And also, you can do things very fast. And I think that costs a little bit in simplicity. Like, if you had a 3D application that was, say, just a modeler, and you started using modeling, and it only exposes its modeling tools, it's already much simpler. For one thing, you don't get into any kind of mode switching, where I think a lot of some things that confuse new users when they use Blender is they have, that there are various modes of editing your objects, of editing your scene. You can edit a mesh, or you can edit objects, or you can animate things, or you can, it's sort of cut up into lots of little editing modes. And With a modeling application, you're just in a modeling mode where you're pushing and pulling points right away. And that kind of is a barrier. Having familiarity with other 3D software really helped, I think. When I started using Blender, I had already used other applications, and for me it was just a matter of finding the same functions and tools and things that I was used to using and just mapping them to where they were in the Blender interface. And for someone who didn't know what the tools before, that becomes kind of hard because you don't know what to expect, and so the interface might seem even more opaque. And the other thing, it does have slightly different conventions from the kind of Wintel or Mac convention. Like, for instance, selection is on the right. You right-click to select things instead of left-clicking to select things, for instance. Some of the normal shortcuts are a little bit different in Blender land than they are in the rest of the world for, like, copy and paste and things like that. So there's a few muscle memory type of things that people assume work that don't necessarily work by default in Blender. You can switch the mouse orientation in Blender to act like other applications, and then I can't use it. But some people do work in that way. The other thing is that the older versions were very hotkey dependent for everything. And so instead of having menus everywhere to access different functions, you just had to know what the hotkey was. And that is a fast way of working, but it doesn't have any discoverability to it. You have to actually look up the hotkeys in some documentation somewhere. And newer versions of Blender are better in that regard. I remember when I first started using Blender, or when I first played with it, which I didn't actually start using it right away, I did a whole bunch of stuff in it, and then I couldn't figure out how to save what I had done, because I couldn't find the saving menu. And that's been pretty remedied. You can find file save in pretty much where you would expect it in the taskbar, in the menu bar in the top of the program. So that at least that part of things is more user friendly now than it was back then. And there are efforts to make the program more consistent and more easy, where it won't sacrifice speed of operation. There are also sort of efforts to reorganize all the buttons. Matt, who is one of the team members in Project Orange, is I think the new UI project is his project, and it's gotten delayed because of Elephant's Dream, because he didn't really have time to work on it while we were making the movie, and so now he's gone back to that, and I don't know which release it's targeted for, but there's going to be an update of the Blender UI, which adds a lot of little things and organizes things in a way that might make it still a bit more accessible to new users.
Cool, because one of the things I noticed when I first started playing around with Blender, there wasn't a lot of documentation out there. There was a few tutorials, and it was a little difficult to pick up. And I came back to it a few years later, and the amount of documentation in the Blender book was now online. Had seemed to really increase. I mean, they've really ramped up what assistance is available. But I'm assuming that if you're coming from a background where you've worked with other 3D animation, 3D rendering software, 3D creation software, it's going to be a lot easier to pick up Blender than if you're just coming in cold and trying to learn this from the ground up.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's true. I think also, like, having the community helps. Like, I think Blender can be a tool for a casual user who wants to do a certain specific thing. I think some people do that. They sort of know what they want to do, and they just pick up Blender and they figure out how to do that thing with it. So it can work like that too. For most 3D artists, it's a big investment in software that has to happen. And that actually includes not just Blender, but most of the big 3D suites that are out there that you don't really expect to become proficient in them for the first few months of using the application. So I think there are exceptions to this, but that's kind of the general rule of things. But I hope that people can pick it up, and I think that the documentation has improved a lot. I think the Blender documentation is now in wiki format on the website, and it's publicly accessible, and I think it's fairly complete. It doesn't include some of the things that are in CVS right now, but I think it really includes most features up to the last release. It's a user manual, so it does lack in some regards. It tells you how to use a feature, but it doesn't tell you a lot of the interesting things that you can do with those features if you put them together. And I think that's helped by the tutorials that are available online. There's Blender.org, and there's also some other thriving Blender communities that have tutorial resources up and people on forums that are pretty helpful to new users. There's also IRC channels on Freenode where Blender people get together and, for instance, there's the Blender QA forum channel, which a bunch of Blender users like myself, for instance, hang out there like whenever we're online. And if someone shows up and asks a question, we try to answer it. Within reason, I mean, if they ask a question like, you know, how do I model and animate a squirrel running down a park, then that's a complex one. But if someone asks specific questions, we try to help them or point them to where they can find documentation or tutorials to assist them with that task. And then there's also the more general, like there's Blender chat where Blender users just hang out and various other places.
So just spending a week and a half playing around with it isn't going to give you the understanding and knowledge that you're going to need to be able to do anything significant with Blender.
But you should be able to do something after a week and a half.
Right.
I mean, it won't necessarily be, it won't necessarily be a full-on... I mean, it depends on who you are a lot, too. I mean, if you've had experience as an artist, if you're a good painter or a photographer, or if you're a 2D animator, or, you know, then I would expect that you would do something much better after a week and a half. Because then it's a matter of learning the sort of technical aspects of using a piece of software, but the artistic side is there. It's a fallacy to think that the computer will just take your input and just automatically make something that looks good. There's a level of it's like learning painting in a way. You can use a brush and paint and start painting, and that doesn't mean that you'll make a beautiful masterwork within the first day you start painting, but I would say that after a week and a half, that you should start seeing results that you like or that show you that you're on the right path or something like that. And if your requirements are fairly simple, if you're not looking to make a beautiful photorealistic rendering or a great snappy animation, if you're looking to do some kind of product spin around or a logo or maybe a floor plan or design for a building, then that can be done, I think, fairly quickly. I think someone could learn how to do that in a week and a half.
So you were in charge of the overseeing the animation, the acting performances, and you were animating characters on many of the shots.
Yes.
You were the director of the Elephant Dreams Project. Elephant's Dream Project.
Yeah.
How much, I mean, is this a hobby for you, or is this your career?
Well, that's an interesting question, I guess. This is my career, I would say. But it's also, I mean, I also like to think of myself as an amateur, in the sense of a person who does something because they love doing it, and not just because I'm being paid to do it. Right now I'm kind of in a, you know, freelance position, though I do have other movie projects that I'd like to make, one of which isn't actually an animated movie at all, and the other one is another short. This is kind of what I do, actually. And Project Orange was the first major thing that I undertook in that area. When we started, we had a fairly, among the team, we had a fairly low amount of experience with a project this big. And even doing little freelance things doesn't really compare to doing a project of this magnitude. A 10-minute short for such a small team and over a small time was actually not a bad achievement, I think. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
No, it does.
I guess when you were working on the project, where were you guys based out of, Amsterdam?
We were working in Amsterdam. Was that a question, or did I miss something?
No, that was it. Now, were you all physically in Amsterdam, or did you work virtually?
Yes. We all worked physically in Amsterdam. There's a very bad history for internet projects that are animation projects. You can find, I would bet, thousands of them that have been started and never got anywhere. In Blender, open source software, closed source software, doesn't really matter. To the point which when someone posts on a forum saying, I'm going to start a movie project, the first 12 posts they get will people saying, don't even try it. It's been tried 1,000 times before, and we've seen them fail. For some reason, it's much easier to collaborate remotely on a programming software project than it is on an art project. I think part of that is you need to kind of work for long hours without the sort of inspiration of things alive. Communicating via emails or IRC is just too slow for the pace that things move. But I don't have any scientific explanation for it other than it doesn't seem to work. One of the first conditions for this project was that we have to do it in a physical studio together and not trying to collaborate from our homes. And so we did work in Amsterdam for the whole period. I did actually come back for almost the entire last month of the project, because my visa to go to Holland was for 6 months, and it expired, and I could not get it extended for the last month of the project. So I had to work remotely for the past month of production, and it was very fraught with frustration and inefficiency. I kind of felt the need to be there from a first-hand perspective, because the pace was so fast that by the time I had emailed someone or said something to someone IRC, taking in mind the time zone difference, it would either be done or it would be too late to fix. And so, not a lot of mistakes were made. Already had a fair amount of communication, and we already knew what had to be done. But there was definitely a massive efficiency, and also my ability to contribute to the project was pretty stalled too, because of the frequency of the updates that people do to the project SVN server would kind of overwrite what I was trying to do. And so oftentimes I would do something and then find that the file that I had depended on had changed, and I would have to either merge the changes or give up on doing those kinds of things, or really try to work on specific areas that no one was working in so that I wouldn't kind of collide with them and end up working on the same file at the same time. And it was pretty painful. I think you could do such an internet collaboration if you had a much longer timeline for the project. And that might work. But again, you would have to keep that energy going for that long time as people went through their, you know, their day jobs and their different aspects of their lives and maybe got disinterested in the project. So I don't think that would have worked too well.
So you got all these guys hanging out in Amsterdam working on this project. Was there commercial backing for this, or are you just there for the love of it?
Well, there was commercial backing. Well, actually, we didn't do any drugs.
That's good.
But we did, yeah.
Hookers?
We didn't have time,
prostitutes.
Actually.
Hookers?
I wish.
Come on, I watched the movie, and I can say that there has to be some hooker-inspired goings-on in there, you know.
Heineken beer.
Yeah, inspired a little bit. But
inspired.
There were some, actually. You know, because you're biking around Amsterdam by the red light district, by various parts, and some visual aspects of what you see did get incorporated into some ideas, at least in terms of the joke. There are little bits of Amsterdam street kind of like in some parts of the visual design of the movie. But really, we didn't have time for anything. It was kind of sad, actually, because there's a lot to see in Amsterdam. It's a beautiful city. And a lot to do. And once we really got going, we were working about 12 to 15-hour days. And most of us were working 7 days a week. Some of us were taking one day off, but mostly not. And when it got into crunch time, it actually got more insane. And a lot of people in the last month would spend a day or two working without sleeping, actually, and then just sort of crash and come back to work again. So it was a really intense schedule, actually. In terms of backing, half of the project was... I'm not sure how the percentages work, but some of the project was sponsored through the Blender Foundation, which does have some sources of funding via subsidies and via the Blender eShop. And some of that funding came directly from DVD sales. We had a campaign to buy pre-order DVDs before the movie was made. And I think we sold something, you know, 700 or 800 DVDs. And now the number is up to like 2,000 and something. And that helped sponsor some of the money. An art institute called Montevideo Time Based Art that was a co-producer for the project. They agreed with Tom to sponsor the project that they provided some of the money, and also they provided the physical studio that we were working in was in their building. I think one of the things that this institute does is that they sponsor artists to go and work and live in Amsterdam and have a studio there and do mainly video and interactive art for 3 month periods. So, you know, an artist will go there, live there, and go into the studio and work on their... So this was kind of a super extended version of that for them, where they sponsored 6 people to be there for twice the amount of time that normally they would have. And also there were other funders for the project, and the rest of it came from the DVD sales, which was very appreciated. I think the total budget was around 120,000 euros. I think I'm not wrong with that. I think that was total budget. So it's still pretty low budget, actually. But it definitely wasn't free, and it definitely wasn't the type of thing that you could do for free. I mean, even if we wanted to donate 6 months of our life, we had to live and eat and have a place to sleep and have a little bit of income. So that wouldn't have been possible, actually. We didn't get rich off it or anything like that. I'm pretty broke right now.
Now, here's a weird question for you. How do you go about drumming up money to work on a project like that?
Well, I think you need a Tom Rosendahl character. I think some people are just extremely good at getting funding, that kind of sort of personal and business manipulation that goes on at marketing and making a project viable. And I think it's a real talent. I don't think it's something that anyone can do. I think some aspects of the way people look at projects like this is they kind of think of things as coming out of a sort of computer or a machine, and they neglect the personal aspect of things. And I think this project could not have happened without him, actually. So he basically, the first step was his determination that he would do it, the kind of large Blender community that was available to sponsor it for the DVD purchases, for instance, was another aspect of things. Kind of similar to, I don't know, do you know the story of how Blender went open source?
Not at all.
No, tell us about that.
It's actually pretty similar in a way. Blender was a closed source in-house tool for a small production studio, and it kind of went through different companies, actually. And the last company that it was the in-house tool of, in fact, the last two companies, I think, made the decision that they would release the in-house tool on the internet for people to use for free. And that's how the sort of Blender community started. And after the internet bubble crashed, the last of those companies went bankrupt. And the investors automatically became the owners of all the assets of the companies, including the source code for Blender. And Tan, the developer, was able to convince them that if he could raise 100,000 euros, that he could buy the source code back from them and start and open source it as part of this agreement, you know, and start a nonprofit foundation that was, you know, the Blender Foundation. And he went online and he posted this news and started the Money Meter and the fundraiser campaign, and basically he got the money within like a couple of months. There were so many Blender users out there who were horrified by the loss of their favorite application that in no time at all, practically, Blender became open source. And the fundraising for Project Orange took pretty much similar route, I think, in terms of the community funding. There was also funding from the EU, in this case, through the Universe project. The Universe project is pretty big, but one aspect of it is this 3D protocol called Verse, that is intended to exchange data between 3D applications to kind of be the sort of HTTP of 3D, allow people to work on 3D data in a client server model instead of having a little closed application where you work on a file and save it. You would have a server for your 3D data, and you would have client applications either on the same machine or distributed over a network or over the internet. And multiple clients can work on the same server data at the same time and modify it. So it can be a tool for gaming. It can be a way for people to work collaboratively. It can be a way for different pieces of software to work as plugins on a pipeline. The Universe Project sponsored the project in part so that we could test how far along Verse had come and whether it was suitable and in what ways it was suitable for production. And so one of the softwares we tested was Verse, and that came with some funding, actually. So that was another source of revenue for the project.
Do you guys get
the art side?
Do you guys get together and have like tutorials or like sessions for people looking to get into Blender?
During the project, you mean?
Just in general.
We did have during the project. There's several things. When the project was going on, we had workshops that we would do. That was one of the ways that we got the funding, actually, was part of our agreement with Montevideo was to workshop for film to come to the studio and to do a sort of quick Blender workshop at various levels. I think we did a few of those during the project. And also, we did a few at the end after. Outside of the project, the Blender Foundation has the Blender Conference, which is happens in October typically, and it's it's 2 or 3 day event, but it includes various talks and workshops and sort of face to face sessions where people meet and talk about the software. Blender's also been historically pretty present at SIGGRAPH, the Special Interest Group Graphics Conference, which is one of the biggest graphics conferences in the U.S. Typically there are probably anywhere from like 40 to 50 Blender users, and there are birds of a feather sessions where people get together and talk about the software, present what they're doing, do little tutorials and things like that. This year, Blender will have a booth. There'll be an open source pavilion type. It's just a small booth, actually, in the exhibition floor where there'll be demos and things that relate to the software.
Now, are you actually part of the development process of Blender, or
only so far as testing and being a user of it. I'm not actually a coder, of Blender at least, and I don't have any plans to be, though I have occasionally, like, done certain things for my own sort of personal use, like when I needed something quick, I would do it, but I never actually did anything clean enough to submit back to the project to the pack, which is sort of built on my part, but maybe someday.
So what's next on the agenda for you guys? Do you have another movie coming up that you plan on working on?
Well, let me think. I don't know for everybody what's going on. I know that the art director, Andy, is working on some personal project that he hasn't released any files for, but that I am supposed to help him bring characters for. Tan is planning on doing a sequel, not to the movie necessarily, but to the project. He hasn't really gone beyond the planning stage yet, but he has some plans for an RNG2 I'm not sure if it would be the same team or a different team at this point. But, you know, that's something he's working on. I personally am also working on a short movie right now, actually, that I'm trying to get some funding so I can actually do it full-time. We'll see how that works. I plan on releasing it Creative Commons as well, if I can. You know, so this things are still in their infancy for me. I haven't done this planning before, so we'll see how that works out.
That's great. You guys,
there's
just,
also.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There's also commercial projects going on with Blender right now. That, I mean, we're not directly involved with, though I do plan on visiting one of them. There's a studio down in Argentina that I work on a full-length animated feature film called Plumiferos, which means free birds, I guess. And they're using Blender, and they've invited me and Andy to go down for a month in sort of a technical advising capacity to sort of share the things that we learned from doing Elephant's Dream with them, and sort of help them with their production a little bit. And they're, you know, they've been going for a while now. There's also, this is completely unrelated, but there's also a Belgian studio that does commercial work for movies, and they use Blender in the pipeline. So there are people using it out there, for sure, for commercial projects as well as personal ones.
So you're starting to see a lot more of pickup of Blender as a tool for you know, professional use outside of you know, hobbyists in the Blender community.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's definitely nowhere near any of the big commercial applications in the number of users, but there is a growing amount of professionals who are using the software right now for various tasks, actually. And there's a feeling that that is going to be something that increases a lot in the near future, actually, that there's some kind of critical mass that's maybe achieved right now. So that's good. I hope so.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great project. What you guys are put together there with Elephant's Dream is fantastic work, and, I mean, I hope to see more coming out of there.
I do, too. I was really impressed with it. I thought I like the way that the – you know, I thought the story was a little odd, kind of like Matrix-y, sort of. But I really like the way the animation looked. You know what I mean? Like, I really like your style that you had going on there. And I'm really hoping that, you know, someone out there is gonna tap your guy's shoulder and – ask you to do some more, because I thought it was pretty cool.
Thank you. I hope so too, actually. It would be nice to do another project like this.
Say it, Pat. Come on, don't hold back.
The response has been pretty amazing. I think most people have been pretty impressed with what you guys have done. What kind of feedback have you gotten?
Well, we've gotten... we've gotten mixed reviews, I would say, and it's fine, actually. A lot of people have been comparing our output to the works of, say, Pixar and DreamWorks, and saying things like, well, this isn't Pixar quality, and of course it's not. I mean, it would be pretty presumptuous to expect that we could produce animation of that quality in our first project. On the other hand, I do think that in terms of animation quality, we did do an adequate job in the most part, and we did improve a lot during the project. One of the unfortunate things that happened was that we started on the scenes in sequential order, and so the first scene we animated is the first scene in the movie, and it's the first impression that people get of the animation. So people are very critical of animation got kind of predisposed from seeing that first scene, and we did get a lot of people saying this actually in some of the reviews, was that, hey, I noticed that the animation gets better a lot after that scene, and it does. Another thing that people critiqued in the reviews, I think, was the story. I think a lot of people feel like it was too hard to understand, perhaps. And there's a few reasons for that. We didn't really want to make... We kind of wanted to make the movie in the spirit of an open movie. We kind of wanted to make a story that left a lot to interpretation. And a lot of times where we could fill in the blanks, tell the audience what was going on, we actually chose not to, because we felt like we wanted to have the story kind of fit the type of project that we're making. That it is an open movie, because one of the things that's neat about the project is that we released the project, not just the movie itself, but also the production files, under the same type of license as the rest of the movie. And we have a very open source attitude about it, in a sense, that if you don't like it, just fix it yourself. So the story is fairly open. It leaves a lot of avenues for interpretation. And so if someone wanted to do something with this, we don't feel like we've hampered people into having to do exactly what we were planning. Needless to say that there actually is a fairly concrete storyline going on in the movie that is decipherable. When we were making the movie, I had the fear that no one would get it. But some of the reviews were very heartening, because a lot of people really came up with, in many cases, what you could call the right interpretation. But I don't like to think of it as the right interpretation. I like to think of it as our interpretation of what was going on. Certainly there were a few other lines of surmise that were actually also, I would call them right. I mean, even though they weren't exactly what we were thinking, I feel like it does touch on the spirit of the story. So I'm not really upset about those reviews, I guess. But
so would you like to share with the listeners out there exactly what your thoughts and interpretation are?
Well,
what the correct interpretation would be, or what you guys had envisioned while you were making it.
In other words, what the hell is it about?
Excuse me? What was the last thing?
Pat says, in other words, what the hell was it about?
Well, you know, maybe I'm being coy, but I often feel like resisting the urge to talk about it that way, because I'd be precisely doing the thing that I avoided doing. That we avoided doing while we were making it.
Don't resist, because nobody resists saying anything on this show. So just come right out with it.
Okay, I'll tell you. It's fairly simple.
We're not going to hold you to it anyway. You know, I think everybody should download it and watch it themselves. Or better yet, buy the DVD, right? So you guys get some of your money back.
It's a fairly simple story, actually. There's two characters in the story that. In front of you, basically the story is just that one of the two characters is trying to convince the other of the existence of this machine that you see. In a certain way, it's as if you were seeing Don Quixote from Don Quixote's perspective, and Sancho Panza just looks weird because he's not reacting to all mythical or non-existent things. So the entire machine that you see around you in the movie perhaps doesn't exist, or to put it better, it proves fiction that you're seeing, or proves side of things. And he's trying to have emo become his audience and sort of see things in the same way he sees them. So he tries to kind of brainwash him a little bit. And a lot of his dialogue is an attempt at mind control. And in the end, emo just, you know, tells him, "Hey, I don't see what you're seeing," and starts mocking him. And when he starts mocking him, he starts repeating the same things that Krug has been saying all along. Krug, in his way of sort of concretizing thought, cannot help but see the things that emo is describing, and he can't stand this kind of disruption of his very ordered universe, and that's why he attacks him at the end. And but it's kind of a pyrrhic victory, because once he loses his audience, he kind of becomes alone and lonely, and it's not so interesting to make things up if there's no one there to listen to. And so, in a sense, the story of the movie too. I mean, we're trying to present the fictional world to people and try to convince them to believe in it on its own merit, and so it kind of is, self-reflexive in that way. But different people see it in different ways, even in the same thing. Like Kant sees it as a parable about religion, and he sees Krug as a typical religious guy who's trying to convince an acolyte or a follower, and doesn't tolerate anyone blaspheming or saying the wrong thing. And I can see that, but I also see it as a more general thing too, because I think that a lot of the things that we do believe in are in a certain way fiction on a certain level, and we depend for the fictionality on other people sort of believing in the same thing. And we don't tolerate a diversion. I mean, you could say that money is a fiction, but that if I start saying, "Oh, I don't believe in this, I don't believe in this," then there will be some real consequences to your actions. You're not free to tell me, "I don't believe in your money thing. I'm going to take this object which I want. I don't see what this, you know, number means." So, I mean, there are many ways in which we create kind of mental structures, and we expect people to kind of follow in those specific structures. And I think that's, in a very general kind of way, what the movie is about. And a lot of people saw that with different interpretations. Like, some people talked about the religious aspect of things, and some people saw slightly different variations on that theme. I think they're all correct, because I think that that's the basic idea. Does that help anything, or does that make it work?
No, that helps.
What?
Yeah, Pat's confused.
I'm kidding.
But that's okay.
The explanation was very
good. He's drunk.
And there are clues in the movie. There are clues in the movie. Like, for instance, you see Krug reacting to things in a different way than Emo does. Sometimes very physical things that he should react to. For instance, Krug has to do this elaborate dance to get over these keys that are coming up the void, whereas Emo just walks. And the idea is that the void isn't really there. There's just the ground. And Krug believes that he has to do an elaborate ritual, and Emo has to follow that ritual. And so he does this dance to go over it. Whereas Emo, who doesn't see what the heck Krug is talking about, just walks straight on. And it's Krug's imagination that supplies these keys that go up to his feet and stop him from falling. Likewise, in the elevator scene, you see Krug reacting to these extreme accelerations and decelerations, while Emo just kind of stands there and looks at him, you know. And there's other things too, but I think I'm saying too much right now.
Not at all. We're still going to tell him to watch it.
I think it looks fantastic.
your system that you bang on all day long, regularly. Yeah. What operating system do you prefer to use?
I use Linux. I used to be running Gentoo on all of my machines, and recently I switched to Ubuntu. So I went from maybe one extreme to another.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, but I really like both systems, actually. I liked Gentoo a lot when I was using it, but as I started to get more busy with this kind of stuff, I had less and less time to sort of wait for things to compile and debug the odd compilation that invariably happens in Gentoo. Especially if you leave it alone for a long time without updating and then once you compile all the programs on your computer. And now I'm using Ubuntu, which I really like, and in a sense it wasn't a big jump for me because I was already using GNOME as my favorite desktop, and so Ubuntu's choice of defaults kind of matches what I was using anyway, and so I'm pretty happy with both, actually. But I'm right now. So.
What kind of setups did you guys use on the project as far as workstations?
We used there's small variety. We purchased three. We built three machines, actually. We got they were Athlon X2 4600, or I forgot the exact speed rating they had. But they were dual core 64-bit processors. We had 2 gigs of RAM in those systems, and we had NVIDIA something or other graphics cards. Modest hard drives, like 150-gig drives, I think. And those were running Ubuntu on them. Two of us were running GNOME desktops, and one of us was running a KDE desktop. I think he installed Ubuntu, and then he used Universe repositories. It wasn't Kubuntu. And we had a Sun workstation that was donated to us by Sun. That had an NVIDIA Quadro in it and had a decent amount of memory. It also was Athlon-based Osteron system. And that also ended up running Ubuntu with a KDE desktop. Let me think. We also had a P4 that was running Ubuntu. We had 2 Macs that were running OS X. I think I mentioned that. Our graphic designer was using a Mac, and our art director was using a Mac. And that was about it for systems there. The P4 was a project server that was running, I think, an older version, actually, of Ubuntu, and it was also running SVN server on it. And so our entire project was on SVN, and we were using to check out and check in binary files. And it worked pretty well. We had some weird things sometimes, which sometimes required people to delete some part of their local branch and check it out again, but we never lost any work. And overall, it worked really well in terms of binary diffing and... I think it does some compression to save the project file on the server disk. So, interestingly enough, the SVN tree on the server with all the history on it was smaller than one checkout, which was, I found quite amusing actually, but very good. That's about all we were running. Yeah. And we also had huge monitors, which was a really lovely thing. We had 24-inch wide LCD screens, which I really miss right now.
Wow. And you didn't get to keep those?
No, unfortunately, we didn't. I think on video cameras, and I think we sold some of them, we took some of the cost. But I don't know how I could have shipped it back to the States anyway from Amsterdam. huge monitor, it seemed like it would just break if you tried to ship it without, like, the insurance.
That's called the carry-on.
Spending half the
carry-on.
Yeah. I think it's over the size for a carry-on, unfortunately.
Oh, that's painful, and that's a bummer, isn't it? Oh.
Yeah, well.
That's.
I'm using my laptop now.
Well. What's a pain is when you have, like, if you use a laptop or whatever, and you have a dual monitor set up, like maybe at work, and then you come home and you don't have a dual monitor set up. That's painful too.
Yeah. Yeah, but you get used to it. Actually, I've readapted now to my little tiny screen and everything like that. And at first, I felt pretty pained by it, but now I feel okay. The funny thing is that my laptop can't render half the project files from the movie. Because it just doesn't have enough RAM. Like, you know, one of our limitations was that our machines had to have a lot of RAM because we used really big texture images. And on my laptop, which actually has a gig, can't render most of the scenes from the movie. You kind of need the 2 gigs for that. Or I need to, like, make a swap file for it that's big enough and then wait for forever. But the funny thing is that they render pretty quickly if you have enough memory. They were optimized to render pretty fast with a lot of RAM.
You know, I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking about your project.
Thank you guys for having me.
Oh, anytime. You guys did a fantastic job. Blender is a wonderful project. And I'm so glad you guys are doing that.
Show it off a little bit. Show Linux off a little bit. Yeah, and he did a good job at it, too. So,
thank you.
And you keep up the great work, Bassam. Keep it up.
Thanks a lot.
Can't wait to hear about your next project, and I hope we can get you back on the show at some time in the future to check back in with you and see what's going on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And are you in the United States now?
Yes, I'm in Massachusetts, actually.
Oh, you're in Massachusetts. Wow. Because I notice, I see that you're listed here on the Blender website as being in Syria and the U.S.
Yes, I'm Syrian-born, but I'm a resident of the United States.
Ah, when did you move over here from Syria?
I believe in 1990.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did you ever go back to Syria?
I have a couple of times. Short visit.
Tell the truth. The reason you're here is because our internet access is better, right?
That's a big reason, actually.
See, that's it. In true geek fashion, you get the right answer. That's what happens. It's what everybody tells me when they come from the Middle East. That they, you know, they like it here better because, you know, geeks have to have that net access, man. It's no good without it.
Yeah, not enough broadband. Really.
Yeah.
But they do have the net, actually. Like, when I did visit there, I was surprised. Cause, I mean, when I left in 90, there was nothing of that sort. And when I went back, I think in 2000, or around that time, I was a little bit surprised to see how much it caught on.
Mm-hmm.
And how many people were using computers to work.
Now, do they have like
Linux there, man.
Do they have like big broadband providers there, or is it, you know, like a dial-up kind of deal?
I think most people are using, at least when I was there, most people were using dial-up.
Mm-hmm.
It was mostly dial-up, and open source is pretty much unheard of over there too. I mean, some people know about it, but it's much, much smaller proportion than it is here.
But is there like a big black market over there for Windows?
Oh yeah, I mean, all the software there is not.
It's pirated,
I mean,
right?
Nobody buys software.
Yeah. See, now that's what it is. You know, people don't look for any other alternatives because they don't have to pay any money for Windows.
I believe that. You know, the sellers of these software, while they might wring their hands over not getting licenses for those copies prefer it that way than if people actually research an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have this kind of, they have a potential market there now, because if the country's economy picks up to the point that it becomes feasible to enforce sort of software licensing there, then they have an instant market on their hands, like right away, because you know they have all these people who are just used to using Windows, I think, and very few people who know alternatives. So I think it's to their benefit. I think piracy is working for them in this case. But.
Sure. Sure. I want, you know, I sometimes I wonder if what would happen if they, you know, if Linux was actually demonstrated to some of those people, if they would think it's better, you know, just based on like merits and usage alone, not price, because obviously price is not a consideration, you know.
No, yeah, price is no consideration at all for them. I think it's the same as I think it's the same as beer. I think 80 to 90% of the users could care less what's on their system so long as they can use it.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever is installed on it when they get their box is what they're going to use. And I don't think they would actually see a difference in terms of this is better than that. I mean, so long as they can go on the web, check their email, do their chatting or whatever it is they do, write some papers, then they're done, pretty much. The only exception to that is gaming. I think gamers, by and large, will not be happy with the Linux system, unfortunately, because most of the games just run on Windows.
Yeah, so what the hell do they? What the hell do they know? All this yeah. Freaky little bastards out there running, listening to podcasts like what's that one, Logger or some shit like that? I don't know. Crazy sons of bitches, I'll tell you.
At least we won't bash Linux packaging systems here.
Right. All right, guys. That's good, though. Hopefully.
Now, have you convinced your family to be all Linux and not pirating Windows over there, if you have family still in Syria?
You know, I haven't. But, and you know, it's very hard to, you know, for me to even... Even though they're using Windows, it's very hard to actually get them to be able to watch a movie that I've made and be able to get a codec to play it and, properly. And so I admit I haven't dared to like try to get them on anything more exotic than that, because I've had such dismal failures. And like, hey, install QuickTime and then you can see my thing, or install FFD show codecs or whatever, you know. And I've always gone back, well, we couldn't watch it, it didn't work, somehow, you know. I've been kind of curious about that.
Now, you bring up a good point
If they were closer to me geographically, I'd consider it more, actually.
You bring up a good point there.
And the funny thing...
Because I'm looking
and
at...
the funny thing is that...
I'm sorry, go ahead, finish up.
You go first.
Oh, I was just going to say, you bring up a good point there, because I'm looking here and I'm noticing I don't see a Theora version of Elephant's Dream.
Well, I think there will be one, actually. Part of that is just logistics of how things worked out. When we were doing the web release, we were all sort of scattered around on the internet. And we lost access to the project server that was in the Montevideo building. Still don't have access to it. So we couldn't make it. We couldn't make a Theora version from the command line on there. The one person on the team who actually had a good high-res compressed version of it had it in a QuickTime format that we had made sort of like almost as a lark. And so he made all the different encodings from that file, and it was very hard for him to go from the QuickTime movie to, I think he tried to do Xvid and he tried to do Theora, and he couldn't really do it without going through too many too many encoding and encoding and decoding processes, which would have lost the quality a little bit. I still hope to make a Theora version of it at some point and put it online. And I think also Exvid was another one we wanted to do, but I'm not sure how, because I actually don't have access to our renders anymore. That's all sitting in a server in Amsterdam that for some reason I can't log into anymore. But hopefully that'll get fixed. And of course, due to the nature of the project, people are free to make their own encodings off it and put them online too. And we'll probably link to those from the project website if and when that happens. So there is that aspect of things too.
I look forward to the AUG version, Theora version.
Yeah, me too.
I'll just have to go and convert mine into Theora right now.
There you go.
That's it. And then I can have bragging rights.
Exactly.
Right.
But we'll link to it from our project site. So link the server now.
Yeah, mine will end up with, like, the audio track about 5 seconds behind the video track.
That is really hard, actually, getting the audio and the video, because what we have on the server is a bunch of PNG files. It's all the frames of the movie, and getting the compressed video file was easy, but then actually getting the audio and the video, you know, synced together and working properly was a bit of a pain, actually. I don't know exactly fully the problem, physically present in the building trying to do it. And I had only limited access to the server, so I actually did one of the MPEG-4 compressed versions in an SSH session, and then someone else did the muxing of the audio to it. But I don't know exactly what the difficulties they encountered, but I remember that it was somewhat of more of a process than it should have been, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for coming on, because we're actually running out of time here.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, we got to close up in a minute. I appreciate it. I mean, fantastic job. Thank you for coming on and sharing your experiences with us tonight. And we look forward to talking to you again sometime in the near future.
Yep, had a real good time talking with you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. Me too. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. And we got to hang up and have a good night.
You too. Bye.
Talk to you later. Bye.
And there you go, folks.
That's Bassam.
What the hell was going on with the audio?
He was like getting lower and higher and lower and higher.
You know what? I wonder if he was calling on a cell phone or something like that. Cell phone or cordless phone. Because what happens with Asterisk is that we're already dealing with a level of compression on our end for Asterisk.
Yep.
And if you call in on a cell phone or a cordless phone, they also do compression. And sometimes the two kind of do battle. You know what I mean?
Yep. The volume was dropping and hiring up.
Yeah. Sometimes it was really, really good, and sometimes it was really crappy. It could be, too, you know, when he was loud and he was talking directly into the phone kind of thing, I guess. But either way, really good interview. I realize some of it's hard to listen, hard to hear.
What really sucked is he started getting into some really interesting things
about Syria. Yeah.
And then it's like going like this. He starts talking about really interesting things. It comes back in like this.
It's the same thing with you, Dan. When you start talking into the wall instead of your microphone.
Dan starts picking his nose.
But you got to turn your head to pick your nose a little bit, you know, because you got to. It's over there. You got to turn a little, move away a little bit like that. You don't want to flick it on your microphone, you know. You get that stuff. It sticks on your styrofoam nose right here, and then, you know, you can't get that off. It's like concrete.
So what exactly happened last week, Dan? We had a multiple failure, right? More than half the episode was gone in the bin bucket in the sky.
That's it.
It's a combination of two things, right? We had...
It was two things, which I explained on last week's show. That for some reason, Audacity crashed out with a Watchdog error.
Dum, 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 dum.
And under Dapper Drake.
On PPC.
On what? Yeah, on PPC.
On your Apple laptop.
And then the hard drive we recorded the backup onto was full. When we started to record.
And how big is the hard drive?
5 gigs.
Did you check the hard drive this time?
Yeah, no, I
recall. See, now he's going to turn it. Watch, he's going to turn it on here now, and we're not even recording or something like that.
No, we are. I erased the hard. I deleted all the files on that hard drive. Last week. This was every single show from when we started all the way up to now.
And you erased them all.
Yep.
Cool.
What was the point? I mean, we have the DVDs.
That's true. Yes,
we have them in
on the archive,
and each one of us has copies of them. And this was only the MP3s of, you know, some of the shows from when we started 8:30 or whatever till when we shut down.
Yeah. Get in my belly. I love that commercial.
Got the evil.
That commercial is so freaking funny.
Which commercial?
I want to eat your baby.
Yes. What commercial?
It's with freaking fat bastard in there.
Yeah, what commercial?
Mini-Me?
He's talking to Mini-Me, telling him he's gonna eat him, right? I'm going to eat you.
Oh, what talking about?
And Mini-Me's making so. What the hell's commercial for?
I don't even know.
Was it a phone company or something? I forgot it. Anyway, and Mini-Me starts talking about some kind of crap. Blah, 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 blah. And it switches back to Fat Bastard, and he's like drooling and singing, I want my baby back, baby back, baby. You know? And then Mini-Me talks a little bit more, and you see Fat Bastard, and he's like, get in my belly! I'm going to eat you.
Get in my belly!
Get in my belly! It's funny. I get a chuckle out of it.
That's one of Mike Myers' better characters.
Yeah.
His best movie by far has to be So I Married an Axe Murderer. You ever see that?
That's funny.
I saw it a long time ago.
That's funny. But that fat bastard character, man. I like him. He's pretty good.
Damn, I'm hungry, man.
Pretty good. I'm starving.
You need that Burger King commercial.
Freaking dude, you know what I've had to eat
today? Oh,
I had
like a half a guy.
That's right. I had a half a sandwich and like a bowl of... like Chef Boyardee spaghetti and meatballs.
Ugh, that stuff is the most disgusting.
It's horrible,
shit.
But like you know, everybody was like real busy, and that's all the time I had. Literally, was 2 minutes to wolf down to heat up the spaghetti and meatballs for 1 minute, and 1 minute to actually chow on it without taste.
The worst stuff is ramen noodles.
And
man.
Then everybody on the
I love ramen
chat
noodles.
Ramen noodles are awesome.
I lived on
everybody
that
on the
college,
chat
man.
Is talking about freaking rallies in Columbus, which is just killing me, man. Like, I want to drive
there rallies?
Now.
What is that, like a burger joint?
It is the burger joint, the premier, best, most awesome burger
Speaking
joint.
Speaking of Columbus, are we going to the Linux Fest in Ohio?
I think we should.
I think we should, too, man.
I think we should.
Especially since Boston is bye-bye.
Number one, I miss Columbus. Number two... Linux World really gets the finger from me today, man, because seeing that email that they sent out about how they have, you know, they had held their little focus group thing and decided that what they really needed was to screw all the Linux users and the developers that might want to speak to the users, and they want to focus more on a corporate kind of thing. And they're going to move it from Boston to New York, which, you know, is more convenient for us because it's closer, right?
But it's in a hotel. Yeah. It's just a conference.
Except it's just a conference, and it's just for it's a business
people,
conference,
yeah, pretty much.
Like, what the hell are you going to get out of that? You know what I mean?
Like the old shows at the Javits Center, those were cool.
Yeah,
we used to go to those.
They're
going to
get money out of that.
They don't understand that they need to have. There needs to be a forum on the East Coast. That allows the user, the end user people, to get a hold of the people like who write the damn distributions and stuff. And they all need to be there. So perhaps we can just bang down some doors and tell everybody that they need to meet us at the Ohio Linux Fest that's coming up in September.
That sounds like a fun time, man. I think I'd be into that.
Whoa, hello.
What?
We still talk?
No, I just
did the fan just go down or something?
Yeah. I turned the volume down.
My volume went down on the fan or something. I was like, whoa!
No,
but I mean, if we don't...
I turned the static down.
We got to do something like that because you know, it really is a sucky thing to hear that Linux World is closing up shop for everybody that lives on the East Coast. Oh yeah, still you can go and visit all your favorite people at the Linux World Expo in San Francisco.
I'd like to go to that someday, but it's expensive.
But
you know?
Yeah, it's freaking expensive, and you know, some of us
gotta
don't
move
like
to San Francisco.
Some of us don't
Thweety.
Like to ride on planes. I mean, so.
Dan will be hitting the Castro.
The Castro? What's the Castro?
Yeah, right. You don't know what that
no,
is.
No, I don't know what the Castro is.
Okay.
No, what is the Castro?
That's the gay district.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Well, apparently Pat does.
I've been to San Francisco twice. You can't miss it.
Now I'll tell you.
You can't miss it, man.
Now I'm really worried, and I'm glad that there's kind of a wooden grate on the back of this chair, you know.
Oh, man.
That wooden grate's easily removed from the back
hey,
of that
don't look
chair.
At me, man. I wasn't the one who went to Brokeback Mountain by myself.
Was that you?
That was you. You went to that.
What the fuck he's talking
no,
about.
I didn't see it.
You said you were going to go see Brokeback Mountain.
I wanted
Brokeback
to see
Brokeback
it.
Mountain.
Did you see Wetback
oh,
Mountain?
Oh, that faggy cowboy movie thing there.
Did you see Wetback Mountain?
No.
Oh, that's funny.
Wetback Mountain.
Carlos Mencia.
Wetback Mountain.
That's pretty funny. That is pretty funny.
Underlay.
Yeah.
Shit. No, Chico. Claw under the barbed wire.
It's good. You could Google it when you get back. You'll find it. I watched it today. Wetback Mountain is pretty funny. I guess there's a.
Is that on YouTube? YouTube's got some funny shit.
It wasn't on YouTube.
Shoprets is the Blue Oyster. Yeah, the Blue Oyster Bar. Dating yourself there. Probably no one remembers that movie either. You guys remember that movie, don't you?
What?
With the Blue Oyster Bar?
Yeah, that was
Police Academy. Police Academy.
Oh, Police Academy.
Police Academy.
You know what? Those movies were so forgettable. Especially after seven?
Yeah, after seven, yeah. You had to, like, recycle the characters and shit. All right, anyway, we gotta close up shop, man. This
do we have
is,
any proper map shout-outs?
Do we?
I think we do. Not many, but it seems the Frapper map is kind of slowing down a bit. Let's see.
Who what freaking show is this? This 141.
141. Let's see.
Oh,
who
are that issues?
What do we got? We got... Pat McKay from Iowa City. We've got Brian Wingle from Mannheim, PA. We've got John Pytorak from San Luis Obispo, California. We've got Jeff Inkitz from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. We've got Magnus Thurning from Cambridge, England. We've got Steve Burton from Owensboro, Kentucky. Jimmy C. from El Paso, Texas. Alan Harper from
Bundaberg,
Queensland, Australia. That's it for this week. Next week, we're talking to Mark Shuttleworth, which is good. Ubuntu's coming out right around the corner.
Yeah, and you know what? His publicist was even, like, psyched about that. Oh, yeah, cool. We can get you talked to Mark right before we release the next Ubuntu.
Perfect timing.
Yeah. So we get, like, the inside scoop.
Should be good.
On the stuff.
So, Dan, I enjoyed your locker episode. Very good.
Oh, thank you.
No Linux package bashing this week?
No, you know what? I want to make a comment. Because I didn't want to comment on this on Logger because it's not the show for it. But Kizzle had made a remark on episode 8 and said about security in open source software and how could you be sure the software you're using is any more secure than the other software that you could that's not open. That, you know, the binary that you pull down and install, how can you be sure that there aren't any Trojans or bugs in it?
It takes some surgery, right?
And
I
guess...
pull your head out of your ass first?
No. I guess my
this is better.
My reaction to that, my response to that is number one, if you are using a binary, then chances are, you know, there is a possibility of it being Trojaned or... having a backdoor or something in there. It is always possible.
Yep.
But that's the reason for the source code. And, of course, you know, you're using a binary that was compiled from the source code. And if you don't trust that source, then you probably shouldn't use it.
Yeah, compile it yourself, right?
But the source code itself, if you want to compile it yourself, you could read the source code. You could view the source code and know that there aren't any Trojans or backdoors. And that's the critical difference.
At least not in the one that you're compiling for yourself.
Right. Right. So that code is out there for audit. And chances are, if you are using a binary of the compiled source, that there have been enough eyeballs that have watched it and have tested it and have made sure, you know,
right,
that that's not doing something it's not supposed to.
Especially if it's something that has, like a Linux binary goes through, people make packages of it, you know what I mean, for a specific version of Linux, a specific distribution. Someone will make a Red Hat package, somebody will make a Mandrake package, somebody will make a Slackware package, somebody make a Debian package. Every time that happens, somebody is looking at that code. At least one somebody.
Right, and you know what?
You can pretty much bet if there's packages out there for a piece of code, it's been looked at several times, and if there was something in there that somebody was going to find, they'd have found it by then. You know?
But it's not unheard of I think it has happened in the past.
Anything
that
is possible.
That a compromised server... Yeah. Has had and that's what an MD5 checksum is for.
Sure.
To help out with that.
Yep.
And even that is not, you know, foolproof. There's always the possibility
someone could crack it.
If somebody compromises your server and uploads a bogus MD5 checksum,
mm-hmm.
you know, and with a new compromised binary,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, there is that possibility, but I think the risks are a lot greater.
You're getting into such a remote, you know what I mean? It's such a remote thing. For something like that to happen,
the question is, Dan,
possibilities.
Will you be doing Xbox reviews this week?
No.
Okay.
No.
No.
I'm disappointed now.
I can't believe it.
Going to be doing Xbox 360 reviews, Pat.
Yeah, baby, on the program.
He won't be doing any reviews because he'd be downstairs playing with his Xbox.
Yeah, I wish I. Yeah. Uh huh. That'll be the day. You know, I think one of what's interesting though is if somebody put out a compromised binary, their reputation would be shattered in the community.
Oh, absolutely.
If they put out a compromised binary,
yeah.
Like Sony.
We're right. But then, you know, in a closed source environment, you're right. Sony puts out a rootkit. You know, you got like Gator and all these WeatherBug and all these other applications linked with all this crap.
You're still there.
And, you know, nobody is like, woo, hey, you know, whatever. Okay. It's like, what the hell?
Yeah.
We're waiting for the official Microsoft rootkit.
It's coming in January.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Vista.
Have you read some of the reviews lately, the beta 2? It's not good.
I saw some demos.
What'd you think? It's very different from what they've done before, right?
Yeah, I was thinking of that. I was driving around today, and it was interesting because CNET, there was a demo video of Vista on there, and I had mentioned that on the IRC about half an hour ago as to whether KDE, if you hover over a minimized application, will pop up a little preview window of what it is if it's down in the taskbar and you pull it up. Down in the panel down there, if you hover over it, will it show a little preview window of it? Because Vista is touting that as being one of their new features that you can actually look at, you know, the windows. And I will say, one of the things that, what is it called, Aeroglass has, with being able to cycle through your windows that are or current applications that are open, it looked pretty neat. I mean, it had this, like, cascading window effect that was going back, and as you cycle through them, they come forward, and the next one drops to the back. That looked pretty neat. I'll give it credit for that. But they had talked about the new security features that are in Windows. That any application or any service or any application or any service or whatever that makes a call to write to the hard drive or to registry or like to install something. Produces a prompt window where you have to verify that you actually want to do this. And what the guy had said was that it is a nice security feature, but it is one of the more annoying features of Vista that you have to get accustomed to because I guess, you know, when you start using this, it's going to be throwing up prompts all the time to verify that you actually want to, you know, write this or allow it to access the disk or do this and that. And the concern that I have is, you know, of people shutting this service off or checking the box, always let it do that. That it seems what they have done, instead of fixing the holes that they have, they have just, you know, like posted guards in front of these holes. like a checkpoint at each one of these, a toll booth, so to speak. And the toll is you having to click the mouse all the time. But there is that option. Instead of having to click the mouse, you can get the easy pass and just cruise on through. And what
easy pass.
what has history shown us? That the masses aren't going to want to stop and pay the toll at the toll booth. They're just going to cruise on through with an easy pass.
Buy the easy pass.
How's your hole, family? Yeah. How's your hole?
Yes, Mr. Red Peters. But, you know, and I think that's a problem. Because if you've ever used SpyBot Search and Destroy's Tea Timer, you can begin to understand what kind of a pain in the ass this feature is going to be under Vista.
I don't know. I've read reports where supposedly vendors were requesting that Microsoft remove some of the security protocols they had set up in the new version.
And those vendors were McAfee.
Symantec.
Link Security Firm.
One All hand, right, guys.
One hand washes the other, Dan. One hand washes the other. We're going to wrap it up, I think.
I got to get the hell out of here. Good night, everybody.
Episode 141.
That's right. Thanks for coming and listening to 141. Listening to us sit here on the wrestling table and yak back and forth again. And
hopefully this is here this week.
Yep.
What's here? What? Huh?
The whole episode.
No, it's still going. It's recording. Like I said, I've done multiple tests throughout the week to verify that this thing was going to record more.
We're good as long as we're not, like, you know, hitting each other with the wireless access points, right? Throwing them at each other.
All right.
My microphone doesn't stink anymore.
Oh, gee.
Oh, wait. We did Frapper shout outs already, right?
Yeah, we got some. You want to play some music?
Yeah, I got some music right here geared up to go.
What do you got?
Some Jonathan Colton.
Code Monkey?
No, we played that already.
I Want to Eat Your Brains?
Yes.
That's a good song.
We're going to play that. Dude, man, his shit's just so good. I definitely want. I will definitely shell out the $50 for that box set. I mean,
it's funny shit, man.
I played some for my wife. My wife loves him. I mean, he's got some really good stuff. JonathanColton.com. Definitely. Check it out. Great stuff. And it's all PodSafe music. And, in fact, he'd like you to let him know if you played his songs on your podcast. Speaking of podcasts, is everything cleared with FeedBurner now for you?
I don't know. I haven't looked at it.
Well,
they said it is.
In a minute. That's what they said. They said it is, but is it?
I don't know.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Here's Jonathan Colton's Regarding Your Brains. We'll see you next week.
Hey, Tom, it's Bob from the office down the hall. It's good to see you, buddy. How have you been? Things have been okay for me, except that I'm a zombie now. I really wish you'd let us in. I speak for all of us when I say I understand why you folks might hesitate to submit to our demand. But here's an FYI, you're all gonna die screaming. All we wanna do is eat your brains. We're not unreasonable. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes. If you open up the door, we'll all come inside and eat your brain. I don't want to nitpick, Tom, but is this really your plan? Spend your whole life locked inside a mall. Maybe that's okay for now, but someday you'll be out of food. Guns, and you'll have to make the call. I'm not surprised to see you haven't thought it through enough. You never had the head for all that bigger picture stuff. But Tom, that's what I do, and I plan on eating you slowly. All we want to do is eat your brain.
mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. You open up the door. We'll all come inside and eat your brains. Ground somehow. Meanwhile, I'll report back to my colleagues who were chewing on the doors. I guess we'll table this for now. I'm glad to see you take constructive criticism well. Thank you for your time. I know we're all busy as hell. And we'll put this thing to bed. When I bash your head open,
all we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're not unreasonable. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. Open up the door. We'll all come inside and eat your brains.
How do you keep screwing it up?
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush.
Shut up.
Just shut up. It's over.